Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Oklahoma Perspective. Earlier this month, the state of Oklahoma commuted the sentences of over 500 inmates in the state penal system. It was the largest mass commutation in U.S. history. Before the sentences were commuted, KRMG's Russell Mills talked to Steve Bickley with the State Pardon and Parole Board about the process and what information would be used to determine whose sentences would be commuted.
Thank you for taking the time. We are on with Steve Bickley, who is Executive Director of the Oklahoma Pardon and Parole Board. Potentially a day really unlike any other in U.S. history. That just really interests me. Can you kind of explain to folks what's happening?
Yeah, criminal justice reform in Oklahoma has brought about several changes. Back in 2016, State Question 780 was overwhelmingly passed by the citizens of Oklahoma that made simple drug possession and property crimes of less than $1,000 misdemeanors. Then this year, in 2019 in May, House Bill 1269 was passed and signed into law by Governor Stitt, which allows the Pardon and Parole Board to, if you will, commute the sentences of inmates whose crimes would now be considered misdemeanors. So those inmates with simple drug possession or property crimes, less than $1,000. And on November 1st, that's exactly what we're going to do. It's the first day the law goes into effect, and we're going to meet in a special meeting and go through that docket and recommend inmates to have their sentences commuted.
Now, my understanding is there are, according to this article that I found, 793 inmates on the drug possession docket and 99 inmates on the property crime docket. I'm not very good at math, but I think that's 892 all told. That's like 900. I guess what I'm getting at is you guys have obviously done a lot of the groundwork ahead of time in anticipation of Friday.
Yeah, there's 900 inmates that we docketed for this, but that doesn't mean every docketed or eligible inmate is going to receive a favorable recommendation. There are inmates that have conduct issues that will get an unfavorable recommendation from staff. There are inmates with DA's objections, and so they'll get an unfavorable recommendation from staff. And the way the process will work is staff will recommend either they be recommended to the governor, because the governor has the final say in this, but we make a recommendation to the board that they either grant or deny the recommendation for commutation. And the board then, as an independent board, they can agree and vote either in favor or denial of the staff recommendation. And then whatever they recommend is then passed to the governor, which is signed into law. And so that's kind of, if you will, the process that happens. And so just because you're eligible doesn't going to mean you get a recommendation. Once you get a recommendation from staff, it has to be approved by the board and then approved by the governor.
Gotcha. All right. So now, for those who do not get that recommendation, does that mean they're still on the track to eventual commutation, but a slower track? Or does it mean that chances are they're just going to have to serve out, you know, whatever sentence they have remaining?
That's a great question. If an inmate is denied, and the recommendation is it would be to deny accelerated single-stage commutation relief, then those inmates could still apply for the traditional two-stage commutation process. So the only recommendation of granting or denial is around accelerated single-stage commutation, which is allowed under House Bill 1269.
Okay, so that's that, and that explains it to me. All right, so the two-stage commutation, the extra step in that process would be what? Like an actual interview before the parole board or something of that nature?
So stage one is where an inmate fills out a full application for commutation, and they explain the basis for which they believe they should be granting a commutation, the change in the law in this case. And we do, our board looks at a jacket review and says, is there enough merit here to warrant further consideration? If there is, they're passed to stage two. What happens between stage one and stage two is we do a full investigative report. And so stage one is really just the inmate's point of view, and then stage two has an investigative report that looks into the facts, the circumstances, notifies any potential victims, and notifies the DAs to see if there are any objections that this is being considered. All that information then is put into a case file for review, and the inmate gets a personal appearance at stage two, and then the board votes on it at stage two. If it's approved at stage two, then it goes to the governor for the governor's approval or denial. That process from start to finish is about a six-month process.
So what we're doing here to expedite this situation, because we have hundreds of people that will be in prison for a crime that is no longer a felony, thus, you know, and makes perfect sense that we would, you know, readjust. And oh, by the way, really doesn't hurt the old prison overcrowding problem either, right? So there's that. And that is one of the reasons that criminal justice reform is happening.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, it will help, you know, relieve some of the pressure on the system. But the goal has never been just the simple release of inmates. The goal has been, let's get them the tools that they need to be successful. So the ones that have been docketed and potentially eligible for release, Department of Corrections held transition fairs. And these are nonprofits came in to the prisons and said, we're here to help you with housing or, you know, sober living housing or employment or mental health counseling or family counseling or transportation. And there were 40 different nonprofits that came in to these transition fairs to let the inmates know all the resources that are available to them from nonprofits and community partners to help them to be successful. And so the process isn't just about releasing inmates. It's about helping them successfully reenter society.
Which, you know, is kind of the whole idea, but unfortunately recidivism remains a thing. But these folks are not violent criminals, right? This is, we're talking about crimes that are now misdemeanors because they're not, you know, they're not violent or they don't involve excessive value or property worth, you know, more than what, $1,000?
Yeah, $1,000 is the threshold, and you're right. The whole goal of this is to release the low-level nonviolent criminals. And that's why we've gone through such an extensive process here with looking for the conduct of the inmates in prison and working with the DAs to see if they do have a history of violence in the background so that only those inmates that really fit that low-level nonviolent criteria are the ones that are recommended for accelerated single-stage commutation relief.
Stephen Bickley with the State Pardon and Parole Board. The Veterans Administration has been going through changes recently to improve the service to veterans and servicemen in the U.S. Recently, KRMG's Russell Mills talked to Dr. Paul Lawrence, Deputy VA Secretary, about those changes.
All right, so we are here with Dr. Paul Lawrence. Understand that you are an economist, I guess, by education with, obviously, a PhD in economics from Virginia Tech.
That's correct. That's correct. I was always interested in economics. I think it helps understand how the world works, what motivates people and incentives, and it's really cascaded into the job I do now to try to get everyone focused on serving veterans.
And before you were appointed, which happened spring of last year.
That's correct.
You have sort of, I don't know, sort of focused your career on where business and government intersect. Kind of explain a little bit about
That's correct. Before I became part of the administration, I was a consultant working with government agencies to better understand, you know, how they operated, how they become more efficient, how they serve citizens. So a lot of what I had done as an advisor, I now do as the leader of the organization.
And let's face it, it's a big organization. You have a lot of employees who answer to you, and you have a pretty sizable budget. What is it, $111 billion? billion.
That's correct. So the Veterans Benefits Administration is one of the three administrations in VA, Veterans Health Administration, the hospitals, most of the employees. But VBA, 24,000 people, we have a budget of $4 billion to operate, but we administer over $110 billion in benefits to our nation's veterans. I mean, America is very generous to its veterans, and we administer the programs that Congress has promised our veterans.
So would that include things like the GI Bill?
That's correct.
Housing benefits?
Not so much housing. The GI Bill, insurance, compensation. If you've been injured in your time in service, we offer you compensation. Pension and fiduciary, if you're unable to take care of the benefits you've earned, or you know your kids or whatever, we provide someone to take care of you. Transition and economic development, as you leave the military, how can we help you? Things like that.
Okay, so obviously Oklahoma has a lot of veterans. We have a very high percentage of residents who have served. And we've got some large facilities, one of them being in Muskogee. And my understanding is your visit was basically to look over what's going on there. What kind of tell us why you're here and what you saw.
That's exactly right. We have a benefits office, part of the VBA, in Muskogee with about 1,500 people that helps us administer the benefits. One of the things they do there that only a couple places in the United States, a couple of our offices do, is administer the GI Bill. So I was there looking in on the final preparations for what will start on December 1st, which is the completion of the Forever GI Bill. It was a law that was passed in 2017, which changed the benefits. And so it affects how student veterans are paid when they go to school for their monthly housing allowance. So that's getting ready to change, and it'll go into effect for the spring semester, which starts in December in terms of the computations and calculations. So I was checking in on how they're doing, are we ready to go? And we were actually joined by a congressman from the House Veterans Affairs Committee who was doing oversight, constitutional role, making sure we're ready to.
Who was that?
Mike Levin from California, Congressman Mike Levin.
Okay. So explain how it's changing. What is the change that goes into effect?
Sure. Well, up until 2017, the GI Bill was limited to 15 years. You had to use it within 15 years of getting out of your service. Gotcha. Forever GI Bill made it forever if you served after January 1st, 2013. Had a bunch of cool features that people are thinking about veterans. One's called Vet Tech, high-tech apprenticeships. So if you don't want to go to the traditional college route, you can learn how to do things like take care of the equipment like we're sitting in front of you now. Something called STEM scholarship, if you're very interested in science, technology, additional benefits for you to go to school. And what really changed was the computation of how you're paid for your housing allowance. It used to be based on sort of where the main campus was, but now we know students are taking classes in different campuses, so it's now based on where you take what's called the preponderance, most of your classes, so that it better aligns with where we think you are.
So basically, this is trying to bring the whole system in line with the realities of the day. A, we need more people trained in technology and STEM. B, people learn remotely now. They don't necessarily go to a campus. They may not leave their living room to get a degree these days. Basically, just modernizing this
law. Right. The GI Bill goes back 75 years. It's the 75th anniversary this year, and it's been changing over time. These are just the latest changes as it reflects what veterans need, what the appropriate benefits are. So you characterize it exactly right.
All right. Now, I know that when we were talking to your folks about your visit, we talked a little bit about what they're doing here in Tulsa, and sure, I know that's not your wheelhouse, but I imagine you've heard some rumblings about it, because basically what they're doing is taking the outpatient clinic, the behavioral health clinic, and the dental clinic, and consolidating them into one nice new facility. But overall, I think the thrust of the question is, what else is the VA doing to try to modernize it, to try and make benefits more accessible, to try and get the information out to these veterans? Because a lot of times that's the problem. They don't know what's available.
True. Right. So one of our biggest concerns is exactly your last point. People don't understand that veterans don't understand they've earned these benefits, and they should feel comfortable coming to us to get them, whether it's health care, whether it's the more traditional benefits I've described. Our biggest frustration is them not knowing, oh, I did not know. Or even, I came once 10 years ago, I didn't realize maybe it's a good idea to check in every 3 to 5 years to see what's changing, so there's different benefits. We do a lot with communication, from traditional letters, don't don't forget, many of these folks are older, to the latest social media things and all points in between, so that we can let veterans know we are here to help them. And perhaps most importantly, our secretary, my boss, Robert Wilkie, Secretary Wilkie, his main charge of it is customer service for our veterans. Let them know we're here to get to yes. His anecdote is it shouldn't take an army of lawyers to get the benefits you've earned from VA. So we welcome people coming and finding out what's available for them.
So in speaking with the American Legion, the VFW, in recent years, they're seeing declines in membership because what they're telling me is the younger veterans just don't seem to be inclined to join. They don't seem to be inclined to take advantage of some of those programs, some of the things that they offer. Is it similar with the VA? Are you having a hard time sort of convincing some of our younger service members that, hey, you know, like you said, you've earned these benefits. It's not a handout, and we're here for you.
Not so much. They'd like everything online. That's the difference, right? So I think when I've been to American Legion and VFW posts where people engage, have social activity, American Legion baseball and things, that has been a group of people, primarily a generation, that like to go to those things for the fellowship as well as the engagement. Now they'll even talk about the younger members. It's a little more challenge to get them to attend. They want everything online. So that's something we think about, back to your previous question about how do we provide good service to veterans. We're trying to imagine what can we do more online? You know, how can we expedite and move things that way? So it's available in the way that veterans are able to consume it most naturally.
How is the very first, the longest continuously opened VFW post in the country, VFW Post 1 is in Tulsa. I don't know if you knew that.
No, I haven't had a chance to visit that. I visited. You know, I think I might have, as a matter of fact.
We've got, like I said, we have a very proud military tradition in Oklahoma. One thing I wanted to ask you about is how is the shifting demographic? We have a lot more females in the military these days than we've ever had before. I would imagine we probably have more, ethnic minorities and religious minorities. How is the VA sort of dealing with the shifting demographics of our service members?
Well, I like to think well, but we're studying it carefully. So the secretary is very clear that women participation in the military is going up. It'll be about 20% this year, or closing in on 20%, which means the veteran population is going up. It's lagged. It's about 9% now, but we can easily see it moving into double digits. And it makes us really study hard what are the gender differences in how you access your benefits, both health care as well as the more traditional benefits that I administer. And are we aware of those, and are we taking steps to make sure they are not inappropriate? So I know the hospitals are greatly concerned about women's health and the like. The Congress asks us about that regularly. In VBA, we're also concerned about, you know, what benefits are affected by gender, and are we aware of that and dealing with it appropriately?
All right. So your task here, if I understand it correctly, is to come out, take a look at how things are going, go back and report to the secretary, and eventually that, of course, will go to the president. And can you tell us, what's your report going to be like? What are you going to say?
Well, the report's going to be like, you know, we're ready to implement the Forever GI Bill, that the Muskogee office is very efficient and effective in its prosecution of, you know, preparations for this law, that Oklahoma veterans are well served, not only by VA, but I've actually been to visit the Oklahoma Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm pretty impressed with what goes on there, and the interaction between our two organizations is pretty good and aligned and in sync. So I would say, you know, our facilities here are one of the top performers, both medical as well as the benefits. So, you know, things are moving where we'd expect them to be.
It must be kind of nice to serve in the government in an area that's sort of bipartisan and not have to deal with as much of the bickering, huh?
Well, it's a good time to be at the Department of Veterans Affairs, right? So the president has made veterans the centerpiece of his administration. Congress, the bipartisan thing you point to, has been incredibly supportive. We have the largest budget in the history of the VA. Sort of honoring the obligations. Secretary and his team are focused on it. As you know, unemployment is low, which means veteran unemployment is low. So it's all kind of lined up, and we're just trying to, you know, deliver on all the promises in a way that's efficient and effective.
And I think it's hard to find an American who would argue with the necessity for that.
Yeah, no, right? America supports veterans. And, you know, our thing is when you do something for veterans, when you support veterans, America wins.
Deputy VA Secretary Dr. Paul Lawrence. Special thanks to KRMG's Russell Mills for the interviews. This is Oklahoma Perspective for Cox Media Group. I'm Bert Williams.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.